We are in week two of three, looking at the life of Jonathan, just in this series of sort of short little biographical sketches. We started last week, kind of looked at sort of the leading up to where Jonathan enters the scene in the early parts of 1 Samuel. We're kind of going to deal with the middle part, and then next week kind of close off the story. But even as I think of Jonathan, I just think of the scene that Melissa read from as there's this celebration in Jerusalem. Saul and David come back victorious from battle, and you get the crowds of people lining the streets. At least that's how I picture it. I know I'm kind of adding some of that sort of in my mind. What would that look like? The streets lined, the armies marching, the two heroes, and these women and the crowd singing, Saul has slain his thousands, and David his tens of thousands. And you can almost kind of picture the look on Saul's face as those words are sung. The envy, the rage, the anger. Meanwhile, there's another man who's hearing the same thing. He's watching the same parade. He's the crown prince. He is the one who ought to be honored. And instead of envy and bitterness and rage, there's joy, there's love, the celebration, two radically different things. One man whose identity is all about being shaped by achievement and performance. Another who has an identity just shaped and rooted in the fact that there is a God who is mighty, who cares for him. Which means that as they live out their lives, one man who just longs to be first in everything will be crushed when anyone succeeds. Meanwhile, another man will be able to celebrate, even when others rise above and beyond to the point where he will lose his own position in it all. And I'm stunned by the story because I think it is just such a rare thing. And yet, when you see what Scripture teaches, it ought to be the way that the people of Christ live. I will not have time to walk through all the parts of the story I wish I could read. I'd love to read for you chapter 14. I'd love to really dig into chapter 17. We will spend a bit of time in chapter 18. I'd love to even get you into chapter 20. Next week, we might have a little bit of chance to kind of dabble back into those things to see the whole story, because the story kind of works itself out in amazing fashion. If you think back to where we were last week, we kind of left at this moment in 1 Samuel chapter 14 as the Philistine army is there, and they are superior in every way, superior in position and number, in technology and weaponry. And the nation of Israel, all the rest of the nation hides, and they are in fear. And there's just one man, and you actually see it in chapter 14, verse 1, if you get the right translation of the first couple of verses, which my Bible says, one day, Jonathan, the son of Saul, it actually says literally, on that day. It's like, well, what day? It's like the day chapter 13 just told you about, when the armies of Philistia march in and set up and surround the armies of Israel. And they're all terrified. And you get the shocking contrast of this. And Jonathan's like, this would be a great day to go to fight. And on his own, with his armor bearer, who, by the way, is one of the most epic guys in the whole story. I know a couple of the small groups were wrestling and mentioned this. What a guy. It's like when Jonathan's like, hey, here's the plan. The two of us are going to go and attack that Philistine garrison. Now, to get there, we're going to have to climb up that mountain that's been called Thorns and Shiny. Shiny probably because it was like so slick and slippery that to get up is going to be an effort. They're going to climb up this mountain, exhaust themselves to get to the top to fight to the Philistines. Jonathan's like, that's the plan. And the armor bearer's like, that's an awesome plan. I'm all in. And if you ever find a friend like that, you grab hold. The thing that I really want you to see in this story before we move on is just this theological, it's a belief conviction. And even when I say the word theological, I don't want to lose you. I don't want to like have you just kind of stop listening because it sounds like we're getting into weighty things. It's like, this is what Jonathan believes about God. Here it is, verse 6. Jonathan said to the young man who carried his armor, come, let us go over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. In other words, like, these are people outside of the covenant of God. It may be, actually, I love the translation. Some translations say perhaps. I just like that. Perhaps it may be that the Lord will work for us, for nothing can hinder the Lord from saving by many or few. The armor bearer is like, great idea, let's go for it. There's the theological conviction. Jonathan, and I'm sure he believes other things, has this belief in God. God can save. He can do it by many. He can do it by few. The people part is actually irrelevant. The God part is the entire relevant part. God can save. And perhaps today is the day he will. And I just love that. And I hope as you kind of think through your own faith and your convictions that you'd grab hold of that part. We don't know the mind of God. We don't know the purposes of God exactly in each particular situation. But there's this conviction. It's like, why not step out in faith? Because perhaps God will show up and do the things that God can do. And if we never step out in faith, we're never going to see if today was the day. There's Jonathan. Now, over the next number of chapters, you're going to see a few things start to unfold. You're going to see this moment where Saul is going to lose the kingdom, and in large part because he just cannot obey the voice of God. But it's like Saul transforms in a very short time. He goes from the guy who last week, when they want to make him king, they're like, okay, Saul's going to be a king. Where did he go? Oh, he's hiding in the baggage over there. They got to literally drag him out to make him. And in a few short chapters, by chapter 15, he's setting up a monument for himself. And I said, and I still mean this, if you come across someone who's convinced and dedicated to making monuments to themselves, stay far away. And I don't mean like a pillar, but just that is the direction of their thoughts and the ambition of their heart, because Saul will destroy a lot of people with himself. Through that moment, God says, Saul, you're going to lose the kingdom. You're no longer going to be king. I'm going to replace you with a man who's after my own heart. And I suggested last week, in many ways, you can already start to see it. It's like, Jonathan's the guy. Jonathan has this courage and conviction about God. Surely he's going to be the guy. And that's the surprise. That's the unexpected piece of what's really going to take place in the story, is Jonathan will step back so the Lord's anointed can take his place. Now, as I mentioned, there are lots of passages of scripture that I would love to read for you this morning that help me understand this story in better detail. Philippians 2 would be great, you know, all these kind of amazing passages in scripture that just kind of all fit together to help us understand what's going on in this situation in 1 Samuel. But the one I really want to just consider for a moment before we carry on is in 1 Peter chapter 5. It's one of my, I don't know if favorite's the right word. Yeah, I think I'll go there. I think it is. It didn't used to be. It used to be one that I'm like, I don't understand how this works. If you ever have kind of read through scripture, like you read something like, I believe it to be true because it's God's word. So I'm not wrestling at that level. It's like, I just don't understand how it works, how the nuts and bolts of this fit. So 1 Peter 5 is instruction, firstly to elders, but very quickly it'll get to instruction to all of us. By the halfway point of verse 5, it says, clothe yourselves, all of you. So like, whether you are a leader or not a leader, whether you're young, whether you're old, it's like, this is to be the mark of all Christians. And it's an interesting description if you think of this notion of clothing. We don't tend to think, at least I don't, maybe wrongly, tend to think of clothing as an identifying thing. Although I was thinking back to high school, and I would say back in high school, my recollection, it was more so that kind of the way you dressed kind of identified which group you were a part of. And maybe that's still the case today. I don't know. I'm a jeans and t-shirt sort of a guy, so I'm not sure what group that puts me in, the slovenly. But it's just sort of my wardrobe conviction. It's comfortable, except Sunday mornings. I dress up especially for you. But when Peter says it, here's what I think is going through his mind. He understands that in the world he's living in, how you dressed communicated identity. Rich or poor, dressed differently. Educated, not educated, differently. Slave, free, differently. City, rural, differently. And so what I think he is communicating to us is something along these lines, that when he thinks of followers of Jesus, he wants their identity, he wants the distinction of their lives to be rooted in one particular trait. When people see you, they should see humility, right? All of you, clothe yourselves with humility towards one another. Like that's to be our identifying trait. The core of our identity is humility. Now, I think we'll get to the why as we wrestle through this real quick here. He goes on and gives us, I guess, a reason to do this. And the reason is not, hey, have humility about you so that the world sees you, they're drawn to Jesus. I think that happens. I don't think that's irrelevant, but that's not his reason. His reason is something to do with his belief in God. And he says this, God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. And if you're kind of picking a lane, it's like, do you want the God of all things, who is infinitely powerful and wise and is all present, to oppose you or be for you? let me think about that for a minute. It's like, you want him for you. He's going to oppose the proud. He's going to give grace to the humble. So Peter says, so lean that way. Have humility about you. And then verse 6 and 7 is really the heart of the matter. And probably I hope it's familiar to you. Here's what Peter says. Humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, so that at the proper time he may exalt you, casting all your anxieties on him because he cares for you. In other words, Peter says there's two massive convictions that those who have discovered the joy and freedom of humility have come to know. Number one, God has a mighty hand. He is not weak. We talked about this last week, right? With God, there is nothing impossible. There is nothing going on in your life today that is too big for God to step in and be able to work and save and transform. Nothing. Number two, he cares. He's not distant and removed and disinterested. He cares. And so Peter says, when you have those convictions, my God has a mighty hand and my God cares for me, you can humble yourself. You can say, I don't need attention and acclaim, if there were to be any, of anyone else, because my God cares about me and he has a mighty hand. Now, I remember wrestling through, it was like, probably it's because of a little bit of where I come from, like just myself. I'm kind of an introvert. Many of you know that. I'm the kid I still remember as like in school. It's like anytime any teacher's like, we need someone to give an answer. Don, you give an answer. Like beet red instantly. I'm like, ah. Oh. You know, it was just kind of part of my makeup. And then there was these other people and they appeared so confident and sure of themselves. I'm like, there's a part of me that longed to be like that. And over the years, I kind of had to come to grips with like, well, that's just kind of how God wired me. It's okay. But I've wrestled a little bit with this idea of pride and humility and how it works. And I don't claim to have all the answers, but let me share one observation that I think I see in this passage and I've come to see it. And it's easier if we pick on little children for a moment, right? Because if we ever talk it at the adult level, it's like, ooh, that gets personal. Let's just think about kids for a moment. Have you ever seen a child who is like a handful, I don't know the right word, and they're doing goofy things and they're always trying to get attention, right? And as an adult, you're like, I don't know, is it cute or annoying? It's somewhere in the middle. But at the same time, if you can imagine the right scenario with me, there's a little bit of you that's sad because you know that they're just desperate to be noticed. They're desperate for attention. They're desperate for someone to say, look at me, look at me. So that they know there's someone who cares about them. And I think sometimes when we see what we identify as pride, it doesn't come from a position of actual confidence and strength. It actually comes from a really sad spot where someone is not sure that there's a mighty hand of God who cares about them. And so they're desperate for the attention and admiration of other people because they're actually in a really sad spot. And as I think of what Peter, I think, is wrestling through in 1 Peter chapter 5. That's partly where I've come to and how I read the passage. And here's the tragic part, just as a bonus. You and I both know that when there are people in our lives who are like that, they're the people who always have the story that can see you and raise your five, if you know what I mean. It's like, I went on a great summer vacation. Well, I went on an even greater summer vacation. I got a new car. I really like it. Well, I got a newer, better car. Like, where you just, at some point, it's like, can't you just have a little bit of joy for what's going on? No, they always go beyond because they're looking for that kind of attention themselves. You move away from that kind of person, right? It's not like, wow, that's great. I want to spend my life with a person who's living in a perpetual, you know, the Christmas letters where it's like, let me tell you how awesome my life is. And you read it. It's like, wow. And here's the really sad part of it. The more they try, the more people move away. And do you get why that's a problem? Because they are desperate to know there's someone who cares. And we're like, I don't want to be anywhere near that. And Peter comes along and he says, there's a way out. And the way out has nothing to do with other people around you. It just has to do with a settled conviction that God is and that he is mighty and he cares about you. If you get nothing else this morning of what I'm going to say next, I hope you'll know that. There's a God and he spoke all things into existence and he created you and he loves you and he is mighty and he cares about you. And I think if we really, really got to the place where we were settled in that understanding, The life that Jonathan is about to live that we're going to see next makes complete sense. You strip away that, and what you're going to see in Jonathan is absurd. Because here is the crown prince, back to Jonathan's story, that when the Lord rejects Saul, you would think he has every right to think and expect and believe he's next. He's just waiting for the moment where everyone comes and bows before him and there's a coronation and he's the king and on the story goes. And instead, in place of, chapter 16 introduces us to another young man. His name is David. And he will be anointed king in a strange fashion. He's anointed king, but there is a king and he's not in line to be king. And at that moment, everything starts falling apart. It's this tipping point in Saul's life. He goes from, you know, some good, some bad, to just this incredible rage directed at David. And you'll see a little bit later, if you read all the way through chapter 20, I think it's around somewhere around verse 30, verse 31. Saul says to his son Jonathan, if we don't kill him, he's going to take your kingdom. Like, Saul's got it right. He understands the situation clearly. I guess that's the point. He is not wrong in the estimation. David will be the one who takes the throne and the kingdom from Jonathan. And Jonathan knows it the whole time. See, there's something about wielding power with humility, but there's something even greater about yielding power with humility. And that's what you see in Jonathan's life. The next story, chapter 17, where at the end, Melissa started reading for us, is that famous, probably one of the more famous stories in all of Scripture, David and Goliath, where the army of Israel waits a month and a half for someone to stand against Goliath. And I've wondered, and I don't have an answer for you, but I do wonder why Jonathan didn't step up. I don't think it was fear. I guess I would take that one off the table. I don't buy the fact that he's the crown prince and too important or precious to risk in battle, because he's already stepped into battle. I'm left with actually only one option that I kind of wrestle to. It's like, Jonathan was ready. Jonathan was ready for David to step up. Didn't go on the battlefield so that David could be the hero. David, in the middle of the chapter, actually towards the end of the chapter, I suppose, gives us his theological framework. This is what David believes about God, beginning in verse 45. Then David said to the Philistine, you come at me with a sword and a spear and a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you down and cut off your head. And I will give the dead bodies of the host of the Philistines this day to the birds of the air and to the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know there's a God in Israel, and that all this assembly may know that the Lord saves, not with a sword or spear, for the battle is the Lord's. It's surprisingly similar, is it not, to Jonathan in chapter 14, verse 6? I know there's a God, and he can save by many or few. David, I know there's a God. He doesn't need swords or spears. Jonathan is there at this moment. And so as you read through the rest of the chapter, you realize there's more discussion and more sort of narrative to follow. And we're going to fast forward to chapter 18 so we can actually get through what I want to share with you, because we're actually not to that part yet. But we're close. In chapter 18, here it is. This is the heart of the matter. I want to just read one verse to you. As soon as he had finished speaking, that's David. So David speaking, giving an answer to who he is to Saul. As soon as he had finished speaking to Saul, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. And he will know full well. He will actually say later to David, this might cost me my life. That is a unique type of friendship. That he would be able to step back in such a way that he would allow a man to usurp him. In fact, that's really what verse 4 is all about. When it says he takes, you know, his, what does it say? He stripped himself of his robes, gave it to David, his armor, his sword, his bow, and his belt. This is not just a sentimental action. This is a display of surrender. This is what a king does when they have lost the battle, to acknowledge and sort of become subservient to another king. This is Jonathan in this moment saying, David, you are the king, and I am not. Now, the verse I want to just make sure we have really crystal clear, that one I read in verse 1. There are three, stick with me, this is actually less complicated than it initially sounds. There are three clauses in this statement. One is a temporal clause. Okay, so that's the first one when it says, as soon as he finished speaking. So that kind of gives us our time period. So you read that and go, oh, okay, it connects with what's just happened. And then there's two other clauses. They're all technically independent clauses. So here's number two. Number two is, Jonathan was knit to the soul of David. Like, that's an interesting image, right? When you, I don't knit, but I've kind of seen, I think I kind of roughly know what it looks like. You take different yarn. You do that, and out comes a sweater. Right? But you, all right, maybe I understand less than I realize. Linda, I'm going to need a lesson later. She's killing herself laughing. She's like, you have no idea what you're talking about. But you get the picture, right? They're now together. They used to be separate. Now they are together. Forever. Interwoven. And then one more clause. And Jonathan loved him as his own soul. Now, the second, and stay, just stick with me here. The second clause, the knit together clause, is something that we would call a circumstantial or explanatory clause. It gets labeled that because of the order of the verbs in the sentence. Like, who cares? It's really, really important. What it means is that second clause explains the third. Think of this for a second. We, in our culture, every time turn that around. What we do is we say, you know what happens first? First, you love the person. Then you commit to them. Is that not what we do? In pretty much every relationship, whether it's, I mean, you think marriage is probably the chief one. It's like you want to fall in love with the person. And then you stand on a platform like this and say, I do, and enter into covenant. This is the exact opposite of that. The second clause explains the third. The second clause is, first he was knit together in his soul. That's the language of covenant. In other words, Jonathan sees David on the battlefield, hears his confession of what he believes about God, and says, I'm hitching myself to that man. It's not about he loves him as a friend and then makes a commitment. It's like, I will make a commitment to him. And out of that commitment comes love. And I feel like if we could just somehow detach ourselves from how culture does this, we would be so well served in our relationships, whether it be friendship, marriage, whatever it might be. I was doing a fair bit of listening to some of the final podcasts and stuff of Tim Keller because we were working through some stuff with our Young Marrieds ministry. And he spends a fair bit of time near the end of his life talking about marriage. Interesting enough, you can go online, you can Google it. It's worth listening to, very interesting stuff. But one of the things he talks about quite often is, and I hope I'm not offending anyone, but he talks about the fact that in our day and age, you might often hear someone say, like, well, why does the piece of paper matter? I've been asked that before. It's like, we love each other. Why does the piece of paper matter? And he has a fascinating answer to it. It kind of goes something along these lines, and I'll try to share it quickly because he does a way better job than I do. He says something like this, that we can have two types of relationship. One is sort of a consumer and the other is a covenantal. And he likens it to the consumer to, he compares it to going to a grocery store where you might go to a grocery store because you're looking for good produce at a good price. But if another grocery store has better produce at a better price, well, you switch. You're not committed to the grocery store. In a like manner, most of our relationships are like that. They're sort of transactional. We're in a friendship, in a relationship for what we can get out of it. And if we can get something better out of it with someone else, we switch, as opposed to a covenantal relationship. So we say, I'm just in. And it's not about getting anything better anywhere else. It's irrelevant to the conversation because I made a commitment. Now, he argues that the piece of paper, that kind of commitment actually is the only way to get intimacy. Isn't that interesting? You're like, the piece of paper, that sounds opposite. Because our world's like, hey, let's just have love. That sounds more intimate than a piece of paper and contracts and signing on a dotted line. His argument goes something like this. As long as you are in a transactional or sort of consumer relationship, the other person at any moment can move on. Okay, so if you're dating, plug your ears for a second. Everyone plug? Perfect. You know it, right? You're dating someone. Are they committed? If they decide for some reason that they want to end that, they can. That's kind of how that works. And so when you're in that relationship, are you not compelled to, what would we say, to put your best foot forward? You hide your true self. Because if this person finds out who I'm really, they're going to find someone different. And it is only in the safety of that commitment and that covenant that you are free to be your true self, therefore free to have true intimacy with another person. That's interesting. And I would argue that's what Jonathan is modeling for us. First, he knits his soul to David, and then he loves him. And every action from this point on, and there'll not actually be many interactions between these two men, surprisingly few. Jonathan will sacrifice himself, readily sacrifice himself, and risk his life for the sake of elevating David. Now, let me point out here, now we're to the sermon, five quick things. Number one, Jonathan had every reason for rivalry. If ever there was a story where someone should have been jealous of someone else, it's these two men. And yet, it's not there. David has no claim to the throne. None whatsoever. He's not a part of the family line. He's not from the right place. Like, it's just, there's nothing in the story where you go, well, I can see why Jonathan would step back, because it kind of makes sense that he wouldn't be king and David would. No, there's no reason for it. And yet there's no rivalry. There's no suspicion. There is on Saul's part. Remember what Melissa read by the very end, right after the big celebration, and they're all, he's killed 1,000. And Saul, the ESV says something like, Saul eyes David. It actually is, Saul looks upon him with suspicion. And trust versus suspicion is a fascinating subject to think through. Because trust means I always give you the benefit of the doubt. Isn't that just kind of the essence of it? Like, hey, let's go to coffee. You go to coffee and I don't show up. If you trust me, you're like, I hope Don's okay. You don't instantly go, he's a jerk. He just brushed me off. If you suspect someone, that's where your mind goes. You go to a negative reason for something instead of a positive. That's the difference between trust. And so when we trust people, we give them the benefit of the doubt. That's Jonathan. He trusts David. What does Saul do? The opposite. Every time he sees or hears David do something, he is convinced he's doing something to harm him. But not Jonathan. He will trust him. There's no suspicion. Number two, Jonathan. In a few weeks, I'll probably come up with a word I like better than this. But for now, this is the best I can do. Jonathan rests secure. There is a security about him. And I don't mean like the physical security part. I already mentioned it's very much in jeopardy. But there is a peace that you see in his life. When he strips off his royal robes and gives them to someone else, he's not agonizing over it. There's a settledness to him. He's not threatened by David. He's actually endorsing and supporting what David's doing. I don't know if you've ever been there when someone you work with gets promoted and they're fast-tracked and you're not. And you might shake their hand and say congratulations, and inside probably doesn't feel like you want to shake their hand. Or maybe it's someone within your own family that they're elevating, their station in life is advancing beyond yours, and everything that they do, all their financial transactions are working out great, and you're just kind of limping along, and those are hard moments. Or maybe it's a friend. Maybe it's even a friend who becomes admires and is doing well in life. But as I already mentioned, when you need to get your identity from your performance and from being first, anytime someone else is succeeding, you're getting crushed. And in Jonathan's case, it's just not there. And as I already said, I think the answer to where that comes from, which is the third point, is that he has this confidence in God. It's almost like the very things Peter says about God, that he's mighty and he's there and he cares. Jonathan's already learned back in chapter 14, verse 6. God's here. And God's certainly able to save. And perhaps he will. And he hears it in David in chapter 17. And so he just has this confidence about him that he is free to celebrate what God is doing in the life of another person. That is actually one of the most beautiful things you could ever have. When you're just at peace with who God is and who God has made you to be, and when others maybe even go beyond you, you can celebrate it with joy. That's Jonathan. He believes God is sovereign. He believes God's purposes are good. And he believes God has him in his hands. Number four. Therefore, in light of the fact he doesn't have to try to grasp anything, Jonathan is free to love without condition, without calculation, without trying to see what he could get from David, but instead what he can give and sacrifice for him. See, when you and I need to win, when our identity comes out of that, we are not able to covenant. Covenant requires a willingness to lay down ourselves, a willingness to be second, a willingness to not be on the rise and allow instead someone else to rise, even in our place. And that's Jonathan. From this point on in the story, right through to the end, it is consistently the story of Jonathan. He has this incredible maturity about him because he trusts in God. Number five, and this is the end. For as great a man as Jonathan is, there is one far, far greater. In fact, if you think just through the lens of Jonathan's story for just a brief moment, he was a crown prince who gave up everything. He set aside what was rightfully his, takes off his robes, lays them at the feet of another, says, even if it kills me, David, I will champion you. 2,000 years ago. You know where it's going, right? Philippians 2 tells us Jesus did the exact same thing. Although everything was his, at his authority, at his power, everything in heaven and earth ought to have bowed. He emptied himself of all of it and took on flesh and went to a cross. And it wasn't just theoretical in Jesus' case. For Jonathan, it was. It's like, even if it costs me my life, David, I am going to champion you. Jesus came knowing right from the start, that's why I've come, is to give my life so that you can live. And Jesus takes his righteousness and gives them to us. Like, it is a spectacular thing. And probably the only spot left to go as we think and unpack this is if chapter 18, verse 1 is an accurate reading, which I am confident it is, that Jonathan commits himself in covenant and then loves, we need to really, really come to a conviction of the way that God relates to us. That in covenant, he commits himself to us and loves us. Both. I'm not saying one or the other, but I'm just saying you can have a settledness about your hope in Jesus, not just because he loves you, which he does, but because he is covenanted to keep you. And that is an awesome thing.